KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. When you are listening to this show, sometime in the summer of 2007, I will be a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society and an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. I am recording a number of shows in late May and early June because over the summer I will be figuring out how to teach contracts as well as intellectual property. And so I will be hunkered down in a basement and figuring out what I'm going to teach in the fall. So I am doing shows right now in order to have that ability. And today I'm very excited to have on Todd Davies. Todd is the associate director and a lecturer of in the Symbolic Systems Program at Stanford, as well as former president of the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. Todd today is going to be discussing a topic that we have not discussed directly on Hearsay Culture. The topic is behavioral economics. Now, of course, intellectual property and economics are intertwined in ways that are pretty obvious, and certainly to anyone who's listened to the show, they understand those connections. But behavioral economics is an area that I think is alluded to in intellectual property law literature, but it isn't often mentioned explicitly. And what we mean by behavioral economics is what we're going to be discussing today with Todd. The ideas of economics that traditionally have focused on the notion of rational man or the rational person are increasingly they've been under attack for quite a while, certainly predecessing any of the technology that we discussed today. And indeed, behavioral economics is an area that is of particular import to the changes in technology that exist, simply because so many users and individuals who previously wouldn't have had access to technology are getting access to it. And it really calls into question the kind of economic assumptions that we make in the intellectual property law sphere, as well as generally. Why do people, for example, post free content on YouTube? Why do people blog? Why do companies increasingly, as we've discussed on the show, look towards incentivizing and innovating outside of their particular company? That the idea of sharing, a topic that Henry Chesbrough from Berkeley has discussed on the show. All of these issues go directly into the questions of behavioral economics, that is, human behavior and how it impacts the economic assumptions that we make, and indeed economic analysis. And in Todd Davies, we have someone who can discuss this at a very deep level, but more significantly for the show, really kind of introduce all of us to some of these ideas and where they apply and exist in the intellectual property law sphere. After an extended discussion in that area, Todd also informed me that he is co-editor of a book that will be coming out sometime in the near future called Online Deliberation, Design, Research, and Practice. And online deliberation, of course, is an area that we've discussed extensively on the show with everyone from Colin Rule from eBay to various people writing in the social sharing sphere. So I'm very excited to have Todd on to discuss both behavioral economics and his forthcoming co-edited volume. So we're going to take another short music break, and when we come back, we'll start the discussion with Todd Davies of the Symbolic Systems Program here at Stanford on Hearsay Culture, KZSU. Well, I think I've done my job properly. It's a lot easier to engineer a show when the guest has graciously agreed to join me in studio. So on the other side of the glass, Todd Davies. Todd, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
Let's start right off with your background and how you got into the behavioral economics space.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes a long time back. originally, I was, after I graduated from college, I was working in artificial intelligence as a computer scientist and researcher. And increasingly, I got interested in in human intelligence. As a model for artificial intelligence and the relationship between computers and the mind, and I decided to go for a PhD in psychology. I wound up in the psychology department at Stanford working under Amos Tversky, who mm-hmm. Is now regarded as one of the founders of this field of behavioral economics. Amos died in 1996, but before he died, he did some really pioneering work with Daniel Kahneman, who's now at Princeton, for which Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics in 2002. Hmm. they don't give the prize posthumously, so Amos was not a recipient, but the committee made it clear that it was for work that they did together. And that event, the granting of the Nobel Prize in what's now called behavioral economics, although Kahneman and Tversky were both psychologists, was very important, I think, for opening up the field of economics to all of the results from psychology and the psychology of judgment and decision making in particular that are relevant to their field. It was given in the same year with an award to Vernon Smith for a related field called experimental economics. Both behavioral economics and experimental economics are empirically based. They're based on experiments. But they come at it from different angles. So watching the interplay between those has been interesting over the last few years as well. But anyway, so I got into it by being a student of Amos during the late 80s and early 90s, and found, I mean, I was one of his last students, that so much of the basic foundations of decision-making, especially for individuals, which was what Kahneman and Tversky really emphasized, had been well laid out by that point. And what I wasn't seeing was applications to lots of areas that I thought it could be applied to. There were applications that were picked up pretty early on in places like marketing, mm-hmm. Finance, in business schools. There were some applications in the policy arena, more kind of in what I think of as the substance of policy. What policy should there be? Mm-hmm. But I was really interested in the procedures by which we come to public policy or make mm-hmm. social decisions, do things collectively, and how our understanding of the rational person or the economic person would affect our theory about how social decisions should be made and the possibility for their being made. So the problem with that was that because there wasn't much work on it, and it to do it in the way that behavioral economists or psychologists with an interest in decision making mm-hmm. had approached this meant essentially studying the theory in the target domain, in this case, political economy and the theory of social choice, and then figuring out ways of testing that in a more psychological framework. So I spent a few years doing that. I was teaching psychology in Istanbul, Turkey, which turns out to be a center for social choice theory. And met some social choice theorists there who were interested in this interplay between empirically how people think about social decisions and the theory that they had all developed mm-hmm. around it. And then when I returned to the States to work in the symbolic systems program, that rekindled my interest in technology from the earlier time in AI, in artificial intelligence. And so I started to see a coming together of the application of behavioral principles to social decision making and the technology of the internet and what that made possible for social decisions and for online, especially group decision making. So I got involved in designing a system for group decision making online. And was doing so with a lot of excitement about what the internet had become and was becoming. But gradually got worried by trends I started seeing in the policy space that seemed to me to threaten the kind of work we were doing. So,
right.
So that got me interested in things like internet law and policy and IP law and so on.
It's I think for the benefit of the listeners, symbolic systems is not a term that mm-hmm. I think is in regular normal conversation day to day. What mm-hmm. is a symbolic systems program?
Symbolic systems is an interdepartmental curricular program at Stanford, which is mostly an undergraduate program. We have a small master's degree program as well. But it's really designed to give students who are interested in the relationships between computers and human thinking, people and computers, a solid foundation in disciplines that have looked at that, so that they can go in any of a few different directions after that. So some of them wind up going into artificial intelligence, which I mentioned, trying to make computers behave in ways that we would call smart or human-like, even though they might not be doing things in the way that humans do them.
Mm-hmm.
Another area is cognitive science, which it's involved with usually computational models and understanding of the human mind and behavior, applying insights from computation and now also from neurobiology to traditional psychological issues. And then the final area is the interaction between people and computers, human-computer interaction and computer-mediated communication. So we tried to construct a core of requirements that would prepare students well to go into any of those three fields. And that what really distinguishes symbolic systems is that we package these three areas together for undergraduates in an undergraduate core and then let them kind of find their direction out of that as a specialization, rather than, as most universities do, saying from the start, you need to decide, are you going to be a cognitive scientist, if they have that even, or a computer scientist who's interested in HCI and AI, or maybe somebody from another field who develops an interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very successful. We have really good placement of our undergrads, both in academic programs, graduate schools, and non-academic settings in industry and organizations. And
it sounds fascinating. As as I sit here, I mean, I'm a lawyer, and I've been a lawyer, and I was thinking, boy, I would have liked to have taken a couple of courses like that when I was an undergrad, back in the dark ages at this point of thinking about these things. And I think from an undergrad perspective in the early 90s, it wasn't quite as developed an area. In terms of behavioral economics, as you were describing and generally the area, I think we should describe the area in a little more detail. But I guess I'll ask you initially, as a broad overarching definition, what is behavioral economics, and then kind of the follow up there is the whole idea of the rational person, which is something which is drilled into anyone that takes micro or macroeconomics 101. You're studying the rational person, and yet, it seems, and I took these courses, and I had a fair focus in labor economics as an undergrad at Cornell, and I remember throughout virtually every economics class, I kept wondering, why are we talking about a rational person? I mean, this is the classic question. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'd ask, what is behavioral economics? And then secondly, given that this is an age-old question, what's your perspective on why behavioral economics is still such a relatively new field?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very interesting set of questions. I would say, we'll start with
what is behavioral economics, because for the benefit of those that aren't familiar, although I think your description kind of alluded to what we're talking about.
Yeah, behavioral economics for the academics who, in the listening audience, who think about universities as being divided into departments and disciplines, I think this will make more sense. Behavioral economics is just the application of psychology and behavioral research, generally empirically grounded experiments or data, sometimes what are called natural experiments from the real world, either laboratory or the real world, to the traditional concerns of economics. And so how people make decisions is a big concern of the psychology of decision making, which is the field that I was trained in as a PhD. And a lot of that work has been kind of imported into economics. And when my observation is when economists are doing it or are paying attention to it, then it's called behavioral economics. when it's psychologists doing it, meeting in their own conferences, then it tends to be called the psychology of decision making or judgment and decision making. And to some extent, there's still separate separate meeting spaces and separate communities who come together in joint conferences and volumes and so on. So it's got a very interesting interdisciplinary history in that, in one sense, it's a great interdisciplinary success. There's been a lot of cross-fertilization. I think first from economics to psychology, and now in the more in the reverse direction, perhaps. But there's also been, I don't know, I would say animosity, but certainly different perspectives that have been maintained over the years between psychologists and economists that keep coming up. It's the difference between people who are who like mathematically grounded theories as the foundation for their discipline versus people who like experiments and data and regard that as the foundation of their discipline, trying to come together and say, how do these things...
And those are very different perspectives on how and how we develop our theories.
Right.
Is it is behavioral economics as you see it today an area that is being accepted increasingly by people outside the discipline? In other words, again, when we're talking about a field that was still in its developmental stages 10, 15 years ago, we're talking about something that, as you just alluded to, still has made perhaps unclear grounding or unclear roots. We see this same by analogy issue in the world of trade secret law, which goes back to British common law, but there's still a debate as to whether trade secrets belong in the realm of property versus tort versus unfair competition. So where is the, in the terms of the grounding of behavioral economics, where do you see it today, recognizing, of course, that you're an economist?
I'm a psychologist.
But from the standpoint of calling it behavioral economics, let me put it another way.
Yeah.
Given that you take it from an economic perspective and the name is behavioral economics, people would make assumptions about, well, this is an economic theory. So I guess in light of this this debate, if you will, between the psychologists on one side and the behaviorists on one side and economists on the other, where is it today? And this is pretty early on the show for me to ask a question in the crystal ball realm, but where do you see it headed?
Well, I think one of the places where it is today is in a lot of interest in among both economists and psychologists in the brain. That's obviously the subject certainly of the psychologist's study anyway. But the development of techniques for studying the brain, imaging techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging, for example, over the last 15 years, have really revolutionized, at least methodologically, how we study the brain and the mind. As a consequence, people tend to think the mind either is the brain or it's something that the brain does. And I've found that there's also this field, which is sometimes called neuroeconomics, that is specifically interested in decision making and the kinds of things economists study when looked at using techniques for studying the brain. But sometimes neuroeconomics also just refers more generally to the psychology and economics and the joint endeavor more broadly. Neuroscience, I think, strikes a lot of people as being more real science than psychology. I, as a psychologist with a behavioral perspective, behavioral in the types of experiments that I've done, tend to not think that. I think that you can certainly do experiments in a rigorous way that are based on observable behavior without actually looking at brain scans or putting electrodes in people.
Right.
But it does provide more evidence about how the mind is organized and about what's happening when people are thinking, which you have to infer a bit more indirectly if you're doing it from behavior.
I came across this topic, as you know, attending a conference at University of Pacific with George School of Law, where you did a talk, and the talk was connecting this area to ICANN, and I'm not going to discuss ICANN today, but I do want to discuss because that's a separate topic, and I've had that discussion with a few other people. I'm more interested today, really, in looking at in discussing in the next 10 or 15 minutes the entire world of intellectual property and behavioral economics, but we'll just do the 15-minute version for purposes of radio. In the introduction, I was mentioning the simple fact that the core, you could argue, of intellectual property law is behavioral. The question of incentivizing and what goes into the decision making process that encourages or allows for an individual to innovate. Mm-hmm. And behavioral economics logically falls in that space. You gave a very interesting talk at McGeorge, which I think I'm correct that you can find some. I think it can be gotten online, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But one of the topics that you discuss, and I guess to draw initially the connection between intellectual property law and behavioral economics, is the idea of loss avoidance. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, again, because these are new topics to the show anyway, what is loss avoidance, and how in your view does that tie into intellectual property? Recognizing, and I say this whenever I'm talking to non-lawyers about the law, that you're not a lawyer by training.
Right. Well, we usually say loss aversion.
Okay.
Meaning, and the understanding of this has evolved a little bit recently, but loss aversion is simply the idea that the things we might lose loom larger for us than the things we might gain when we're facing a prospect or making a decision. And so another way of saying it is that the subjective value we attach to something that we might lose is greater just because we already have it and we might lose it than it would be if we're facing the prospect of gaining it when we don't already have it. And that's been shown quite rigorously with studies of gambles, in the money domain, also with common objects like coffee mugs and ballpoint pens, and as well as things of more value. And it's been shown, I think, also to be a real consequence for people in their lives, not just something that psychologists find in a lab, but that really affects people's decisions.
The segue here, and I think actually I'll kind of float the cliffhanger before we go into the music break, but the segue here in intellectual property, and it also ties into your new book, which we'll discuss a bit after the music break, which are the ideas of cooperation and sharing that are implicit, again, in behavioral economics, but also are increasingly the topic of not only debate but analysis in the intellectual property sphere. It's still, I think, a very much an open question as to what the end game will be as far as social sharing, and whether, in fact, we're going to see that as an increasing trend, or whether the law or behaviors may change as the technology changes. So, unfortunately, being that it's a radio show, and that I think we'd kill people, and I would certainly drive people nuts if I went 3 hours for a talk show, I think maybe we'll take a short music break here, and then kind of segue after the break into a discussion of behavioral economics and social sharing, leading into a direct discussion of your book. So we're talking to Todd Davies of the Symbolic Systems Program here at Stanford University. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM. We will take that short music break right now and then continue the discussion. I'm using World Party a lot on the show the last several weeks. I guess just because I got back into listening to them and I forgot just what a great band they are. But that was Is It Like Today. And at the beginning, we heard Way Down Now. In the middle, the Police classic, When the World's Coming Down. Before we continue the discussion with Todd, now's the time on Hearsay Culture where I ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford that relies on donations from listeners like you, and including the podcast listeners. By the way, I'm not going to let the podcast listeners off easy on this, because I'm sitting in the studios at KZSU, and KZSU gives me the opportunity to put the show on. So everyone that's listening, regardless of whether you're listening by podcast or otherwise, there are a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU, or at least to learn more about it. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can go to email and ancient technology and type underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu in the two line. Underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu, and fire off an email, and you will get a response. So we're back with Todd. And Todd, before the break, and kind of to close the ring on the loss aversion issue, the tie-in to intellectual property, I think, is an interesting one. So what is that connection?
Well, and this is what I try to talk about at McGeorge. A lot of intellectual property, this is my understanding of it, as characterized, for example, by Kenneth Arrow, the economist, is about creating scarcity which wouldn't exist otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, for example, and we can see it now, especially in sharp relief with things like file sharing on the internet, information, especially when it's in the form of bits, doesn't have the property that economists know as rivalness, meaning that if I have something, then it prevents you from using it and vice versa. Instead, information works so that I can give you a copy of it, or I can give you, you know, for example, a song or a file, and I still retain it.
Right.
Which, if we're in a market in which we're paying for things based on their rivalness or their scarcity in some sense, kind of interferes with that model.
Right.
Because I can, you know, the marginal cost in economist terms becomes zero at that point for me actually giving it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the theory of intellectual property is that, therefore, you need to create a legal barrier to sharing of information when it is against the economic interests of the person who holds the rights to it.
Right.
And so my whole point was just that whatever the underlying behavioral theory for intellectual property, when we decide to grant property rights, and in the McGeorge Symposium we were talking about ICANN granting rights over domain names, we are creating loss aversion. Because once people have something,
mm-hmm.
The psychological principle says that means they're going to value it much more highly, and they're going to do, in many cases, a lot to retain that right.
And that idea, the idea of forced scarcity, of course, you know, is something that from an efficiency standpoint we say, mm-hmm. why, but from an incentive standpoint we say, well, that's part of the incentive, that is, that scarcity, mm-hmm. Again, not to get it heavily into economics, but in the simple form, the less that there is and the more demand there is for it, the more you can charge for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these artificial barriers, as you describe them, are indeed, I think that's, that sums it up pretty nicely, at the core of intellectual property rights.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we see in behavioral economics as well as intellectual property this countervailing interest in the idea and the goals of creation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where on one side you enforce scarcity, on the other side you want to incentivize creation, you have a bit of tension. And to me, that tension seems to arise in the realm of cooperation and sharing. Mm-hmm. So I guess before we get into your book, the segue would be, how does that fit into the perspective of a behavioral economist?
Right. Well, this has been particularly interesting for me because it brings in a whole new realm of data and theory and experiments that were not in my direct path of learning when I was in graduate school. I learned about them in courses I had to take in social psychology and so on. But
right.
And that has to do with the theory of incentives. My understanding of intellectual property law is that it's meant to incentivize creation by creating an income stream that people have rights to if others are going to use the products of their intellectual labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has that is based in theories of human incentives in economist terms. It's sometimes called effort aversion,
mm-hmm.
Meaning we don't want to work, we don't want to do things unless we're going to get paid.
I should have known that phrase when I was a kid, mm-hmm. trying to avoid having to do my homework each night. It's just, you know, just tell the teacher I'm just exercising effort aversion, and that probably would have got me away for about 30 minutes.
Right, and actually your homework is a good example because the realm in which this was first studied in psychology was in classrooms. The basis for a theory which is now called motivation crowding theory comes from social psychology experiments that were done by Mark Lepper and others, initially on kids, in tasks like drawing pictures. So kids like to play with magic markers, for example. And mm-hmm. if you give them some markers and some butcher paper, they just naturally pull out the markers and start drawing stuff. And,
right.
and they do sometimes remarkably creative things. What Lepper did was to introduce an incentive to the kids by creating prizes for the best drawings.
Uh-huh.
And then observing their behavior after introducing this incentive. And what he found was that when the incentive was no longer present, when the kids were just there with the markers and the paper, but they weren't, the contest was over, they were no longer as interested in playing with them.
Yeah.
So it was as if the meaning of drawing pictures had changed for them. It had turned into something that you do in order to get a prize,
mm-hmm.
And no longer was something that they were, in his terms, intrinsically motivated to do.
Huh, that's fascinating.
So the idea of motivation crowding theory is that when you introduce incentives, usually monetary incentives, that crowds out the motivation, the intrinsic motivation that people have to do things for non-monetary, non-extrinsic reasons.
It seems like a valuable and scary lesson, mm-hmm. about how human beings can be manipulated in that way. And I guess, you know, manipulation is, again, you know, not to use that term pejoratively, although manipulation does to some has a pejorative sound to it, but manipulation of people's incentives, again, is at the heart of figuring out how we allow for creation and allow for people that ultimately have to put food on their tables to mm-hmm. do it. And where do you see, in the realm of social sharing, to be the biggest challenge from a behavioral economist perspective? Where, when we're dealing with the question of exactly what we're discussing today, and now talking about eliminating or diminishing, probably is a better way to put it, the economic incentive portion of the equation, where is the core of the challenge?
Well, there are many challenges. The motivation crowding idea is deep and rich,
mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't just tell us that the meaning of activity will change if you introduce incentives, but also about patterns of behavior that exist when institutions are created that are incentive based versus a different environment in which that's not the basis for production.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one challenge is just that the way things are set up is very incentive based currently, and particularly we see this in the Silicon Valley. I work with students on this online deliberation work, and they do wonderful programming work while they're students at a wage that I must say has got to be, you know, an order of magnitude smaller than they're going to be making very shortly when they graduate if they work at a place like Google.
Right.
And it's particularly here I find it's difficult to make the case that that a programmer's labor should not be highly compensated in a way that say proprietary software tends to lead to when it's really successful. And I'm not necessarily trying to convince them of that. On the other hand, the types of software that I'm working on have not been are better suited to being free and open source for reasons we could get into.
Right.
And therefore, it puts it in this less incentivizing realm. And so, you know, I've been struck by how difficult it's been just collectively for all of us to produce the kind of software that we need for online deliberation that also gives people control over their own data, which, you know, when things are done in a more proprietary way, usually the company wants to retain the data.
Right.
And I think part of the reason is the dominance of this proprietary and incentivizing paradigm in the market for software.
And that entire issue, and it's, you know, I usually have to say, and this is no exception, that an hour is just not enough time to get into everything I'd like to,
mm-hmm.
but you know, to touch on that issue very quickly, when you're dealing with technologies like software that are everything is created by human beings, that's facile. But when you have software that, as Larry Lessig and many have written about, is written by human beings,
mm-hmm.
and if you believe or accept the concept of code being law, behavioral economists and behavioral economics play a heavy role. So, you know, when we tie all of these things together, and, you know, these are top-level questions, when we tie behavioral economics together to technology,
mm-hmm.
and if I were to ask you, which now I will, what is the core connection? What can we take from behavioral economics? What is the main lesson that we can learn from behavioral economics to apply to technology creation? What would it be?
Mm-hmm. Well, in simple terms, it would be don't take theories like effort aversion and selfishness, which is another core tenet of the neoclassical view of the rational person,
mm-hmm.
for granted in the way we build institutions, in the way that we incentivize people, because there's just lots of evidence that those are not good general assumptions for how people behave.
Mm-hmm.
Not that people aren't selfish in many contexts, and not that incentives don't produce things, but that theories like people won't work or produce valuable things if they're not incentivized, or that people do not derive benefit, this is kind of an implicit assumption oftentimes, do not derive a substantial part of their satisfaction from the contribution,
mm-hmm.
Itself, that we should step back, look at what the evidence really tells us about human behavior, combine that with what technology makes possible and the changes in the nature of what's produced.
Mm-hmm.
Information, for example, has changed a lot with the internet. It's much more of a public good, I think, now.
Right.
Than it used to be, and do new institutional design based on that, rather than kind of starting with the old assumptions and trying to make the old ways of doing things fit this new reality.
For those, before we get in, we have about less than 10 minutes left. Before we get into a little bit, the close of the show, to talk about your new book, for those that aren't either economists or studied in the behavioral sciences but want to get a good overview of behavioral economics, do you have any recommendations of books or websites or even articles that one could look for?
I like the book by a psychologist, Jonathan Baron, called Thinking and Deciding, which is a very accessible introduction to what psychologists have to say about judgment and decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the more theoretical work in behavioral economics is new enough that I don't think there's been a good text or general introduction to it.
Hmm.
But I'd encourage anyone also to look into the literature on social psychology, because
mm-hmm.
I think you asked earlier about where behavioral economics is going.
Right.
One area clearly is in more study of the brain, but I think another thing that's come in a lot more is data from social psychology that were not such an explicit part of the psychology of decision making for disciplinary reasons. It arose within the subfield known as cognitive psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But social psychology, how our behavior is influenced by the social context, is also very relevant. And that's an even older field than the psychology of decision making. And there are terrific books about it. I mean, David Myers is one of the best, both textbook and popular educators around that, and I'd recommend his books, including a recent article in Scientific American Mind on intuition and when it goes right, when it goes wrong.
You can't see it, but you may gather. I'm writing this down as well.
Mm-hmm.
As I read in this area, I have read some of the articles by Tversky and others to get mm-hmm. a grounding in it. They are. Articles written for scholars, and have, I think, basically, you need to have a good background, to really understand everything that's going on in them. I think these are very useful suggestions, and I will post, these names on the website, hearsayculture.com when the podcast goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look for that on Hearsay Culture. In the last 5 minutes that we have, Todd, and this is a fascinating area, and so I'm particularly interested in it, and so I invite you back in the future to continue the discussion, because obviously we're just barely scraping the surface here. But your new book, what is its core, what's the core thesis, or what the ideas are you trying to bring forth in it?
Well, it's a collection of chapters that grew out of a conference that we did 2 years ago on online deliberation here at Stanford. We brought people from around the world who were designers, researchers, and practitioners in this area we're calling online deliberation. And so the book's going to have chapters from people in each of those areas.
Hmm.
And it's called Online Deliberation, Design, Research, and Practice. But the basic idea is being able to use communication technology, the internet in particular, to facilitate collaborative and deliberative activity by groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that has different meanings for different researchers and practitioners and designers. It could mean something like citizens getting together in a message board or chat room to talk about how they're going to vote.
Mm-hmm.
The area, for example, and a lot of recent work has been done on that by people like Vince Price. It can mean something a little more directly relevant to the decision that the group itself makes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a researcher named Jim Fishkin here who's done work on deliberative polling, bringing randomly chosen groups of people randomly sampled groups from a population together to learn about and deliberate about a public policy issue,
mm-hmm.
and seeing how that changes their view of it after a weekend, for example. He's now doing that online.
Hmm.
So he's going to have a chapter in the book on what it means to do this in an online context. And then there's a type of online deliberation that I'm particularly interested in, which is pre-existing groups that are using the internet in particular to do the kind of work that they would formerly have had to do in face-to-face meetings, and what it means to support that, both in software, what it means for people psychologically to be interacting that way instead of meeting face-to-face. And so it's a very rich area, obviously very interdisciplinary, and we just wanted to get everyone together, not everybody, but people from many different fields that are relevant to this. And the book is an outgrowth of that.
Talking about this, I was reminded as an undergrad studying labor relations, I think for me, the most fascinating courses that I took as an undergrad were courses focusing on power and bargaining. Mm-hmm. And in particular at Cornell, Sam Bacharach, who's written extensively about workplace dynamics, toured a two-credit course called Power and Bargaining. And as I listened to you talk about this book, I realized that what I should do, and I'm going to do now, is email Sam and ask him to send me the book list, because this entire area, as it ties all together, especially from an intellectual property perspective, but also from a technology perspective generally, is dealing with what I think at the end of the day, and I've had a number of guests on that don't necessarily agree with this, but really are new paradigms. Mm-hmm. There's a lot, there's clearly not everything is new, and there are plenty of issues that have been studied before, or even in previous iterations of technology that apply today. And so I'm not one that thinks that the technology is so new and radical that there's nothing we can learn from the past. Mm-hmm. But the more that we take a look at technologies that I think at its core are technologies that individual people did not generally have access to in the past, where we have to question all of these underlying assumptions simply because we can do things now as individuals in our homes that we couldn't do before. And again, that's always been true. Every time a new invention enters the home, whether it's television or electricity or sound machines. Mm-hmm. But again, I think it's the ease with which it can be done and a relative inexpensive, nature of the technology that causes us to question this stuff. So I'm inspired by everything you're saying. I when I have authors on, I ask this question. It tends to get a vague answer, and so I give you carte blanche of a vague answer. But as a general ballpark, when can we look for this book? And if you have a publisher, maybe you mentioned that too for people that want to keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, the publisher is CSLI Publications, which is a division of the University of Chicago Press.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is it's in their fall catalog. We're likely to have a follow-up conference this fall, in November, early December. And so my goal is to have the book ready to sell in hard copy before then.
Terrific.
Hopefully much before.
Well, I look forward to seeing the book, Online Deliberation, Design, Research, and Practice, getting a copy of it and perhaps having you back on to discuss it as one of the editors of the book. Todd, I want to thank you for joining me today. Todd Davies from the Symbolic System Program here at Stanford for discussing not only behavior economics and intellectual property, but your new works. Thank you for taking the time today, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime in the near future.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I want to thank Todd Davies for being here today on Hearsay Culture. As always, you can find this show not only by listening live on KZSU, but by also going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the podcast, as well as on CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or finally by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society by typing Center for Internet Society into the podcast engine. I think you'll find, if you go to hearsayculture.com, you will see the schedule as I record this show, and the show is being recorded on June 8th, 2007. I'm still figuring out exactly when each show will air, but you can certainly find guests going into, at this point, pretty much September for the show and get a sense of the wide-ranging topics that we're going to be discussing with people, that all of whom are experts in their fields and who have a lot of interesting things to say. So I want to thank you again for listening to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more of its diverse programming, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.